From health and wellness to education,
we need to be thinking about what it takes for students to succeed.
From art and politics to social issues of the day,
we have young Black males who are thriving in their communities and who are being shown as leaders.
The journey is what matters.
I would say to all of us, we can be better than we are.
Let's join Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, president of Howard University, and his guests as they take steps on the journey.
An educator, civil rights activist, pioneer in the struggle. She's a woman who for decades has had the courage to stand for her principles. She is a former interim president of Howard University. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and our conversation today on the journey is with Dr. Joyce Ladner. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So, Dr. Ladner, obviously you have had quite a history growing up, attending school in the South. Tell me a little bit about your childhood in Mississippi.
I was the third oldest of nine children, and we were poor but didn't know it, is an expression many of us use. My father was an auto mechanic, and my mother was a homemaker. My father always said that he would never allow his own wife to be a maid like his mother had been. He didn't want her working in anyone else's home, so she was there with us all the time. I grew up in a segregated community. I didn't know anything about integration. We had everything we needed. We had our own churches, our own schools, community center, you know, the work. So if we went into a store, all the clothing stores and grocery stores and so on, supermarkets, I should say, were owned by white people. We couldn't try on clothes. If we wanted to buy them in a store, you had to buy them and take them home. And if they didn't fit, that was just too bad. Trying on shoes was the same way. And I always vowed that one day I wouldn't suffer this indignity. I grew up in a family. My mother was one of 11 children, but they were all fiercely independent, and they taught us that we should not allow ourselves to be cowed by any white person. My mother said, told all of us that you have to look at white people dead in the eye and don't blink, because if you blink, then they will try to take advantage of you. So somehow they had figured out how to manage to keep their dignity at the same time not get killed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you attended Tougaloo College in Mississippi, where you earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology, and then attended Washington University in St. Louis. Contrast the two experiences.
Well, my first year of college was at Jackson State, and my sister Dory and I organized a demonstration, protest demonstration, after some Tougaloo students had been put in jail for going to a white library. We got expelled, so that's why we went to Tougaloo, and it was a wonderful experience. But Tougaloo was a predominantly Black liberal arts college. The president and half of the faculty were white and the others were Black. And it was the only liberal arts college for Blacks in the state. I got a wonderful education, and I was also we had support to think our own thoughts and to not be cowed by segregationists. They weren't allowed on the campus, in fact. And then when I went to graduate school, I didn't have any difficulty adjusting at all, and I think I was quite prepared for grad school. I didn't have any difficulty academically either. But it was very different and a much, much more demanding environment to be in graduate school, period. I did well. I graduated from college, high school at 16, college when I was 20, and very similar to you, I had a PhD when I was 24. That was more drive than I could even manage to find these days.
You mentioned, you know, going to jail as part of your activism. Right. Talk to us a little bit about that period of time. What occurred? What led to that, and what that experience was like?
What led to it was that we students on Tougaloo College's campus had decided that many of the shock tactics of nonviolence were no longer of great appeal to the white segregationists. I wouldn't say appeal, but they didn't make them stop and wonder, why are these people allowing us to kick them around and so on. So it was harder and harder to find things that would shock the moral conscience, if in fact they had any morality left. So we organized two types of demonstrations. One, to get entertainers to refuse to perform at an all-white civic auditorium in Jackson. So at the last moment, after the trumpeter Al Hurt had allowed the place to fill up, he then sent word that he would not be performing because he didn't want to perform before a segregated audience. Of course, that made the whites very, very angry. The other was that we organized church visits. We went to white churches, and it was on one of those visits that I, accompanied by one of my professors who belonged to that church, a white professor who invited me there, and two Methodist ministers from the north, they turned me away. And I was taken to jail, and all the other students prior to then had been released immediately. I ended up in jail for a week because Attorney Kunstler, William Kunstler, was our lawyer, and he wanted to put this case into federal court. Back then, he couldn't fax or send by email with attachments his appeal, but he had to drive to Atlanta, then drive back after getting the three judges on the district panel to agree to allow us to go into federal court. So that's why we stayed that long. But it was a great experience. I learned a lot.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Dr. Joyce Ladner. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. To continue along that line, you said you learned a lot. Right. Tell us about the learning experiences.
Well, one of the things that we learned was that we were put in the same cell with the local poor black women who often got arrested every weekend for fighting with their husbands or boyfriends or whatever. And so they protected us. They told us how to survive in the jail. They were to learn about their lives. We'd been so sheltered. We knew nothing about what their lives were like. So I was a sociology student, so I found myself just not formally interviewing them, but I couldn't get enough knowledge about them. I couldn't learn enough about them. That was one thing. The other was that they treated us kind of with kid gloves. I remember I didn't want to eat the food, so I stopped eating. The chief of police came into my cell one evening and asked me if I was sick, and if so, he would personally take me to the hospital emergency room, and I had to really convince him that I was not sick. I was not on a hunger strike. So that was the other thing I learned about the way power really operates. But one final experience we had was that Undersecretary Ralph Bunche, who taught at Howard, was speaking on United Nations Day at my college, at Tougaloo College, and we sent a note to our professor asking him if they would bring Ambassador Bunche by the jail to see us. He actually came to the jail to see us, but because it was not on a Wednesday, on visiting day, they would not allow him to see us. I think that's a great story.
That's incredible. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. Now, you worked with SNCC. We hear a lot about SNCC today, and you see what's happening in our society in Ferguson and Staten Island, in Florida. What are your thoughts and what parallels do you draw from your experience as a SNCC member?
SNCC worker. It's interesting that you would ask that question because we have a SNCC legacy project. And that is, we're doing a lot of work trying to memorialize what SNCC did. But one of the things we just did was to draft a statement. A lot of young people in different organizations like the Dream Defenders and others have asked us to speak out. And essentially what we say is that we don't dare try to tell the young people today what they should do, but we do feel that it is necessary to move beyond the Ferguson grand jury decision to organizing, that protest, while important, must lead to organizing the people that they with whom they're greatly concerned. So I think we're also asked a lot by young people to talk to them about SNCC and how we went about doing what we did. And we point out that it's long, tedious, very unglamorous work. You won't have a lot of the media following you around while you're trying to organize, but it has to go there. Otherwise, it's all for naught. We have Howard students who want to meet with us as well.
Well, excellent. You've been breaking glass ceilings for a long time. And notably, as it relates to Howard University, you're the first woman to hold the title of president at the university. Tell me a little bit about, again, what that experience is like and your view of gender equity in higher education today.
Well, I did not have gender equity as president of Howard University, although I am proud that I was able to serve my university for a year as interim president. And I had a rough year. That was a difficult year for the university, not just for me. I went into the office with almost a $30 million shortfall. And so we froze positions that year. We cut out academic travel. We held student services and so forth harmless. We didn't cut anything directly related to students. And unfortunately, we had to let over 400 staff people go. That was a very, very tough year. So what I remember a lot about it was trying to deal with these tough decisions. And I didn't for a moment think that, if I do this or do that, it's going to prevent me from becoming president. I saw a problem and I tried to, with my team and with university support throughout and outside the university, to try to bring some solutions to the table so that when I left office, we had a over $25 million cushion for the next president. But beyond money, it was a wonderful experience to lead the university. We accomplished a lot, and I look back on it fondly, not with any trepidation, whatever.
And to really underscore what a remarkable year it was, you secured the visit of Nelson Mandela to the university.
That's one feather in my cap. I'd just forgotten about that. When we knew that he was coming to Washington, I immediately went over, got an appointment with Ambassador Swartz, South African ambassador to the U.S., and asked him if we could get President Mandela to come to the campus, and he said absolutely not. And I left that meeting and disregarded what he said, and immediately on my way back to the campus I got on the phone and started calling people, including friends in South Africa. And in the end, we did get President Mandela, and Swartz said, again, you can only have him for 45 minutes. Well, he stayed close to about an hour and a half. But I cannot get the image out of my mind, nor would I want to, of him standing there as he and I ascended the steps to the podium. And he could first see the 20,000 people in the yard outstretched before him. He said, "Madam President, I had no idea that I would have this kind of reception." I said, "But of course." He said, "Why me?" I said, "Why not you?"
Wow, absolutely fascinating. Now, as I've said before, you've broken many a glass ceiling. You've also seen a lot of academia. In the sense of you've been a faculty member, you've worked with faculty for much of your career. Throughout your career, what do you think have been the greatest changes that have occurred and the challenges that face us now?
I think the greatest challenge that you face here is that of keeping good faculty and retaining faculty and of attracting the best and the brightest to Howard. It's tough to recruit, but I think that you can, and I think you have an excellent opportunity right now in presenting the new face of Howard and to do so. You have a lot of energy, a lot of stamina, and you have a sense of mission and a sense of where the university should go. In recruiting, it's often not about the dollars and cents. That is part of it, but it's about giving people a challenge and giving them some excitement about the job that they would come to. And then after that, you have to find the resources. But I think it's a matter of stimulating people and having them see a new Howard and not the same old same.
Madam President, thanks for being here. My guest today has been Dr. Joyce Ladner. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, right here on the Howard University Radio Network.
WHUR is wherever you are. Download our new app and listen to us on your iPhone, iPad, Android, or listen to us online at TuneIn and WHUR.com.